sexual scene. While gay culture is, while male gay culture is friendly toward women, queer culture tended to be outright hostile toward women. Why? Because they tended to think of women as rivals for men's affections and attention, and just basically got in the way. Burroughs, even in his way, even went so far as to talk about woman as an evolutionary mistake. This is the same guy who talks about the human virus. You may, just to go back and think a little bit about Howell, you may remember some of Ginsberg's comments, you know, where, like in this passage, the three old shrews of fate, where he sort of stereotypes women as kind of like the old hag. And he talks about the heterosexual dollar as if there's a, as if heterosexuality is some kind of a basic plot. And lastly, of course, the very familiar idea, which I talked about when we talked about Ginsberg, who copulated ecstatic and insatiate with a bottle of beer, a sweetheart, a package of cigarettes, and a candle, as though the woman on the scene was just one more little item, like you got your beer, you got your cigarettes, you got your woman. So, in other words, the woman as kind of an ornament, or an ornament to the male, kind of like the best dressed, the well dressed man has to be wearing a nice looking suit, and he has to have a nice looking woman on his arm. I leave it up to you to decide how prevalent these attitudes still are, but you can see how basically blatant they were back in the 1950s. Gary Snyder, whom we're going to talk about in the second hour today, even, you know, Snyder, the thing that makes Snyder's ideas unique is that he went back to what are called primitive cultures, and at the same time that he brought back some very useful and challenging ideas from examining the thought of primitive cultures from his study of anthropology, for example, you can see that in some cases he brought with him quite a few stereotypes about women, and perhaps most, again, I use the word blatant, is the poem called Praise for Sick Women on page 291. Snyder has not only lived to regret this poem, but as also someone who really has very progressive views on the subject of gender now. He is somebody who has constantly learned and changed with the times as he's gotten older. But he did write this poem on Beat Reader, page 291. The female is fertile and disciplined contra naturam, which means against nature. The idea that discipline is somehow against nature and that discipline only confuses her. The poem basically carries that you know, that old-fashioned reactionary idea that the primary purpose for women in life is to bear children, and that's what this poem is all about. Diane DePrima, another San Francisco poet, took him to task on the subject, and you'll find her poem on page 361. It actually, if you want to think about women writers in the Beat generation, I would definitely recommend Diane DePrima. She, in her poem, The Practice of Magical Evocation, she quotes, on page 361, she quotes Gary Snyder, the female is fertile and discipline only confuses her. And she comes back very, very tongue-in-cheek and very sarcastic by you know, kind of repeating these ideas in her own voice with a straight face and very ironically. I am a woman and my poems are woman's. Easy to say this. The female is ductile. Ductile means pliable, easily led. And stroke after stroke built for masochistic calm. So she just, she talks about pelvic architecture functional. The cunt gets wide and relatively sloppy. Bring forth men, children only. So it's good to know that she was ready to take him to task on that subject. That'd be kind of an interesting thing for you to study if you're talking about gender relations and gender ideas in the Beat Generation, would be to contrast that poem by Gary Snyder with that poem by Diane DePrima. So there's a book called The San Francisco Renaissance by Michael Davidson, and I'm quoting him here. The Beat ethos relegated women to the role of sexual surrogate muse or mom. So somebody to have sex with, somebody to inspire men to do their own artistic work, or mom. Obviously, this is a very familiar to you from reading On the Road. His aunt, of course, as you know, is in the book, is really his mother, and I don't think it's at all unfair to talk about the Beat Generation as being a kind of boys' club, as Davidson talks about in here. You remember the part where in Dharma Bums where Kerouac is talking about Princess, and he says, you know, well, she wanted to be a big grown-up Buddha herself, but since she was just a girl, the only way she could get in on the spiritual scene was through sex. Well, you know, it would be nice to think, and I do think that we have we've progressed quite a lot on this particular subject. Some people feel as if we still have a long way to go, but it's really interesting to go back in time 40 years or something and see some of these gender stereotypes in their really raw, blatant form. And one reason that you see them in their raw and blatant form in the 1950s is that society hadn't reached a place where people felt that there was any reason to apologize for these ideas. So you can, gender stereotyping in its purest and really most dispiriting and kind of saddest form, the 50s are a very good time to study those attitudes. Historically, women have tended to be the subjects of works of art rather than the creators of art. The female nude is a staple of art. This is a painting by Willem de Kooning. He's another abstract expressionist painter of the action painting school. And you can see this beautiful painting of his called Woman. We're going to listen to another poet.
I want to see what you look like, your face, at all moments, how it is different for...
I'm sorry. I just want to bring the volume down a little bit on this. Maybe that'll help. David Meltzer is another poet of the San Francisco School. And here's this poem called Wife. I don't think this poem is intended in an unkindly way at all. In fact, it's very fond and kind. But that the interesting thing about listening to it is how condescending it is. He's in one room writing. His wife is in another room. And he seems more or less possessed with anxiety that his wife in watering the...
I want to see what you look like, your face, at all moments, how it is different, for instance, in the morning after sleeping hard against the uneven pillow, or before your morning mirror, applying color around your eyes, combing out your hair, combing it down, brushing it upwards. I want to see what the mirror sees of your eyes. Another poem for my wife. I'm in my room and I am writing. I am speaking in myself and I hear you moving down the hallway to water your plants. I write truth on this paper. I strike the word over and over again. Yet I worry that you'll pour too much water on the plants and that the water will overflow onto the books.
So it's another really good example from of somebody who writes a poem that certainly has love in it, and as I say, not intended unkindly. Just the interesting thing about it is how incredibly condescending it is, and how unconscious the writer David Meltzer seems to be of his own attitudes. I want to show you some things by four women painters. These are people who were part of the New York School. You know, when you're talking about art, the visual, but when you're talking about painting, the New York School is more or less synonymous with what we've been talking about, abstract expressionism, and more or less, and abstract expressionism is more or less synonymous with what is called action painting. Remember when we were talking about Frank O'Hara? Frank O'Hara was a literary link between the painters and the writers. He was an assistant curator at the Museum of Modern Art, an absolutely terrific poet. You may remember his poem, The Day Lady Died, that we listened to in this class. These people were part of that group of painters. We're talking Helen Frankenthaler, Grace Hartigan. Grace Hartigan did a lot of collaborations, in fact, with Frank O'Hara. Some of her paintings, she painted the words of O'Hara's poems into her paintings. And then the other two painters I want to show you some things by are Lee Krasner and Joan Mitchell. So these are abstract paintings, obviously. Reproduction is not too bad. So what is it about painting? I mean, just, I don't know if you make a habit of going to art museums, but one of the hardest things is really just to look at something. And, you know, just look at something and take it all in through your eyes. One of the things that happens when you look at an abstract painting, you're always kind of tempted to, you know, think about, well, if it weren't an abstraction, I mean, what does, pictorially, what does it kind of resemble in the representational world? But I have an artist friend who says that the average painting, that most paintings get looked at for an average of 3 seconds. I don't know if you've seen people walk around in an art museum just kind of going from one picture to another, but I mean, it's awfully sad to think that we don't know how to look at things very well. I just want to encourage you, as you're sitting here today, just to look at these paintings. This is another by Helen Frankenthaler. When I was talking to you about abstraction in painting, one of the things that I mentioned was that I don't know if you ever had this kind of stereotype about abstract art yourself. I was kind of introduced to it with the idea that an abstract painting didn't bear any relation to the normal were, I mean, you know, that there was no resemblance between abstract art and representational art. It's not like that. Let me just kind of refresh your memory about the word abstract. I think it's best understood if you look at it from the standpoint that it looks at the world representationally, that is, as a seeing what a person would see by looking at the world, and then it abstracts certain features from that, not giving you the kind of total photographic picture, but giving you some version. And so what would you think of in this painting? It looks, doesn't it look a little bit like a landscape? I mean, I think that's how, that's kind of what it is, isn't it? I mean, isn't this sort of a river, the banks of a river? This is the sky, the sun rising. I mean, it's certainly a way of looking at the painting. You can't just look at it, if you choose to, as just pure design, because obviously there are elements of pure design, because if we're thinking about this is a river or a lake, and these are the banks, and there's some hills in the background, there's the sun rising or setting or something like that. And then you say, well, what is this? You say, well, it's a tree, but if it's a tree, why is it that color? Why isn't it the tree color? So I think when we look at art like this, we go back and forth between seeing it representationally and seeing it just pure. So that's, here's another Frankenthaler painting. One of the things you do when you look at art is to just try to appreciate it as paintings, as pure design. That's a very good way of looking at paintings. You look at this one right here, and you might, this part right here, and you, I don't know, it looks like a teddy bear with ears, doesn't it? You know? What would that, why would that be in the painting? It's funny, I look at it and I sort of see like a ship down there and water here. But then let's talk about the pure design elements of it, like bang, bang, bang. Those three areas of brown that forms a kind of, that forms a pattern. The way the blue here, and the blue down here, the way they all speak to each other, how those are balanced. Typically, a painter at work will talk about, will look at a canvas and talk about, well, it needs something, just, or what does it need? Just like when you're cooking, you taste the soup that you're making, and you say to yourself, it needs something. And then if there's somebody in the kitchen with you, you get them to taste it, and you say, what does it need? And then they'll tell you, salt or something like that. Here's Grace Hartigan. This painting is called Moths. I mean, isn't this a gorgeous thing? I'm really kind of pleased how well these show up. I mean, computer digitized art always loses something. But this gives you a pretty good notion of what this painting actually looks like. Since she called it, the interaction between language and the visual arts is always a very interesting interaction. She calls it moths, and so you, when you look at it, you see moth shapes in it. You could equally well see it as design. And if you, I mean, all these things that I'm talking about, I think, are things that are happening in our minds as we look at painting. It's just, I'm sort of trying to articulate them. And so you're thinking about the relationship between these dark, these sort of blackish brown areas, how these all relate to each other visually, how these browns or chocolatey browns relate to each other, and then how these kind of ochre or yellows kind of have sort of a descending swing down this way. But you know what I mean about looking at things? I mean, I guess it's a very common fault to look but not see, or just not to look at things. But it's a wonderful thing about looking at paintings is just you have your eyes open and you, this, like Ginsberg says, seeking jazz or sex or soup. You could add art to that. That it just, a painting like this just sort of comes right out at you and sort of moves right through your eyes into your brain. I think you can feel that happening when you look at a painting like Grace Hartigan's Moths. So about a painting like, you know, they talk about two kinds of painting, abstract and figurative. Figurative meaning that it's about something, you know, in the sort of layman's approach to art. Well, it's a picture of a barn or something like that. Abstract meaning what the things that I've just talked about, more or less pure design. This is obviously kind of a blend between the abstract and the figurative. Gosh, what a nice painting. And one of the things that I don't know if you've ever had any art history or anything, but one of the things about one of the characteristics of modern art is to approach the canvas as a one-dimensional area. It's just a rectangle of stuff, a rectangle of visual stuff. You see what I mean? There's no perspective in this. There's no foreground and there's no background. It's all coming straight at you on this flat plane. That's if you, like as I said before, if you don't have any, if you haven't looked at pictures, if you don't have an art background or never taken an art history class, that's one thing to appreciate. It's just all one-dimensional. It's all coming at you that way visually. You're not, there's nothing like in traditional art of starting at the foreground and moving by perspective back into the background with the like warm colors in the front of the painting and the cool colors in the back of the painting. That's something that modern artists tend to be interested in, filling up a flat rectangle of space rather than creating an illusion of pictorial depth. Lee Krasner, who had the fortune or misfortune of being Jackson Pollock's wife, this is a painting by her, City Vertical, obviously again by giving it the title she gave it, we're meant to think of it not as pure abstraction, we're meant to think of it as having a relation to the to cityscape, to skyscrapers, and I think if you looked at the painting not knowing what its title was, well, obviously you would be aware of the verticality of all, because it's primarily vertical, and then the changes that happen within the verticality, like a wider shape that's kind of bent, something that doesn't quite go with the verticals, this one that sort of swerves over from one line to the other, and then the play of colors, the warm yellow next to the cool blue. You know what I mean by warm and cool? Warm comes towards you, cool recedes from you. So in traditional painting, you would have the warm colors, the haystack or the cottage or something, in the front of the painting, and that would tend to be down here because the foreground, what's closer to you, it usually is pictured down here in a painting. And then the cool colors that are receding things would tend to go back, and they would tend to sort of go back in a triangle like this, because that's the way our eyes see something that's in the that's close to us receding to something far back. This painting doesn't have an ambition to do something like that, but still it's interesting to see the way she put the cool color and the warm color next to each other, the blue and the yellow. Here's another Lee Krasner. This is a photograph of a big painting, so kind of from the side. This is called Crescent. And you can see that she's very much concerned with pure design, with the square, with basically a kind of a grid laid out by squares, intercepted by the, you have basically two design elements that are working with each other here, the grid created by the squares, and then the big curves that work against the grid or complement the grid. See these two elements going against each other. That's another one, as I say, by Lee Krasner. Now, let's look at a few paintings by Joan Mitchell. You know, one of the hardest things in the world is to talk or write about art, because in a way why do it? Just look at it, just like music. Why talk about music? Just listen to it. But John Ashbery is one of the most celebrated contemporary poets. When he was younger, John Ashbery made his living by writing art criticism, and I vastly prefer his art criticism to his poetry, because it's so clear. And just look how he doesn't use any kind of technical vocabulary to talk about this painting. This is one of the things that Joan Mitchell did, which was an interesting choice. New York was the capital of the art world. Traditionally, through the 19th century and all the way up through the 1920s and 30s, the center of the art world was Paris. As you know from what you've heard about abstract expressionism, the New York school, when a lot of artists fled Europe in the 1940s and moved to New York, New York became the capital of the art world, and it spawned its own movement, that movement called abstract expressionism. So Joan Mitchell, being an American, made a very interesting choice when she moved to Paris. Oddly, by moving to Paris, she moved from the center of civilization in artistic terms to what was a kind of backwater, sort of a sleepy backwater in the art world. Many people have said that the kind of rejection of ambition represented by that move to Paris is reflected in her paintings, because you're obviously talking about an artist here who is not setting out to make it real big in the art world. She's somebody who's just exploring her own view. It's interesting what Ashbery says. It looks strong and relaxed, classical and refreshing at the same time. It has both the time and the will to be itself. Her new paintings continue an unhurried meditation, on bits of landscape and air. That's a very interesting remark. An unhurried meditation on landscape and air. How does air represent itself visually? I mean, isn't air completely clear? You know, I mean, can you see air? Well, I guess from a painter's standpoint, the answer to that question is no, because air does have a certain kind of visibility to it. Painters are often painting not the objects, but the light. And that's what Ashbery's talking about when he's talking about meditation, not some landscape, but on the air as well, the light that is between the painter and the thing that she is painting, or the light that surrounds those. objects. Here's a kind of a triptych by Joan Mitchell. You know, some people don't like painting like this at all. And fine. Seriously, I don't care. That's not my business. I really don't care. But if you want to try to gain an appreciation of painting like this, well, you've got three rectangles. They're all side by side. And then you've got she's put these masses within those three rectangles. And so just think about it in terms of design. Here's this little rectangle. Here's this other one over here. This is what your eye does when your eye is looking, when you're looking at this. This is the activity that's happening with your eye when you're looking at it, and maybe you're just not thinking about it at all. Okay, the overall background is with the paint, the kind of whitish, off-white paint, which is all around which covers the entire surface. And then, how does this bounce off that, and how does that bounce off that? And then what's the relationship visually between that and that? Now, you may not be, and then what's this in here, kind of a balance? This more neutral area is a balance between this and this. Now, you may not even be thinking about that at all, but your brain is thinking about that. Something's happening there between your eye and your brain. You're registering, if you're looking at it, you're registering it, whether you have the, whether you can verbalize it or not. That's another painting by Joan Mitchell, and here's one just called Weeds. The last painting that we looked at is tremendously cool. This painting is tremendously warm. Why is it warm? It's warm because it's got a lot of warm colors in it. It's because, all right, blue. Pure blue is a cool color, in other words, a color that recedes from the eye. This isn't a pure blue that she uses. See, she's using a kind of a purple. She's mixing a warm color red with a cool color blue, and that she gets this purple. And that's why it's warmer than it would be if it were a cool kind of a sky blue, for example. Okay, so that's, I'm just talking about color values. These colors, these sort of burnt ochres, brownish, orangey kind of colors, they're hot. They're very warm. So they stand out. They come forward toward us a little bit. They stand out a little bit from the relatively cool bluish purples. I think it's quite a reasonable thing for somebody to say, well, what's this painting all about? Well, weeds. She calls it weeds. And so you can think, okay, it's a picture of weeds. It's a painting of weeds. She set her easel up and painted some weeds. On the other hand, you can just ignore that title and think of it as pure design. This is that kind of double way of looking at something that you're almost always... that you almost always find yourself in when you are looking about art. So these are several women artists: Lee Krasner, Joan Mitchell, Helen Frankenthaler, Grace Hartigan. Here is another notable. We already talked about Billie Holiday. I'm a little bit ahead of myself. This means field in French. So here's another Joan Mitchell. I mean, I'm kind of giving you some ideas about it, but God, isn't it beautiful? It sure is beautiful on my screen. Just those vibrant blues, and then the dark background of the blacks, and then this little dance of these hot kind of browny oranges. I'd like for you to listen to, we listened to Billie Holiday, I'd like for you to listen to another female singer of the era, Sarah Vaughan. And maybe we can convince Sarah Vaughan to sing something for us here. I was driving in the car yesterday listening to Ella Fitzgerald sing Sunday Kind of Love. And my son, who was in the car with me, said, yeah, isn't it interesting? Ella Fitzgerald sings I Want a Sunday Kind of Love, and Billie Holiday sings Gloomy Sunday. It really, if you know those two singers, it really sums up the difference between the bluesy, despairing pain. Here's Sarah Vaughan. This is more of a song with more of a blues feeling to it. But ain't no use.
It ain't no use of a hanging round. Take your love and go away. When you leave, please, please don't return. Cause it ain't no use. Ain't no use. The best of my years you have wasted.
So you can play this song for that special someone. Comic Lord Buckley, somebody with a less kind reality is the person we're going to listen to now, Lenny Bruce. I don't know how many of you hang out with musicians. Jazz musicians are notoriously inarticulate. People who are really good at music often tend not to be very good with words. So this is the skit here is an uncomprehending journalist is interviewing a jazz musician named Shorty Petterstein.
Uh,
I think you will dig it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like you to meet Shorty Pedestine, who is one of the up-and-coming jazz French trumpeters, as they call them, Oscar?
No, man. French horn.
Would you get a little, just a...
I blow French horn.
Get a little closer to the microphone.
I blow French horn.
Get a little closer, Oz.
French horn, man.
French horn.
Yeah.
And what do they call you, a French hornist?
Well, you know, like I blow horn, man.
Would you speak up a little bit, Oz?
I blow horn, man.
Yeah, fine. And tell me, how do you like Dixieland, Oz?
Well, I mean, you know.
Well, what about, would you say, Tchaikovsky?
Yeah, man.
You don't, you know.
I dig more like, you know, the Bartok scene or Shostakovich or some bit like that, man, because I mean, I'm more swinging.
Well, how would you compare the kind of music play with, how would you compare that with art, you know, what kind of art, artistic?
I think art blows the most. It came with a band about 3 years ago, man, and he was a real, small-town cat, and I mean, he was swinging, man, but he was a small-town cat, and I mean, he started low with us, and he was a real nut,
And who are you appearing with currently now here in San Francisco?
Well, man, I'm on the show with Stan, you know.
Stan.
My combo, and we're going with on the same stand with Stan.
And how are the crowds receiving you down there? They like it.
Well, I mean, they come, man.
It's a little closer to the microphone.
They come, man.
A little louder, please.
Yeah, well...
You want the audience to hear everything you have to say.
Yeah.
See, that's a mighty good drum. What do you call that, rip?
Well, you know.
Now, what are your plans for the future, Oscar?
Man, I'm here, and I mean, I've met a swinging group here. I like Frisco the most, man, because I mean, the town jumps, you know. I mean, there are a lot of scenes, man, and so I mean, it's like that, you know.
What would you advise a young artist, a young musician, to do? Would you advise them to get an academic education, or strive immediately for self-expression?
Well, man, I mean. I'm a musician, Dick, and I mean, to me, the most important thing is, like, you should blow, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, I tried to make it a Juilliard, man, and it's a real bad scene, you know, man? I mean, it's a bad scene,
Bad scene?
Yeah, man, I mean, it's not, you know, like, nothing's happening, you know? I
you
mean,
mean
cats don't blow, no.
They don't have any classes
nothing,
up
man,
there?
Nothing, no, man, nothing's happening.
Well, I was sure that there was something happening up there in Juilliard.
Well,
they have classes.
Yeah, I mean, sure, they have classes, man.
That's a very fine professor music.
But they're too far out, man. They're on this Schoenberg bit and job like that, and I mean, it doesn't swing, you know?
Uh-huh.
I mean, if a cat wants to blow, and he wants to blow, and then he's got to have a scene where he can blow.
That would apply to the artists that are playing horns and wind instruments, so they would have to blow. What about those who, for example, are playing string instruments, or would you say that, how's the picture there?
Well, I mean, it's pretty much all the same, man. A blow is like an instrument, you know?
Blow is like an instrument. Uh-huh. Well, perhaps there's some verbal communication that we don't seem to be getting across. How do you say blow is like an instrument?
Well, man, I mean, don't hang me, you know? I mean, I didn't want to fall up here in the first place, man. I mean, this is a big bug because, I mean, the manager of the band,
well,
man,
okay, thanks. You just go over there and sit down with Pops, and we'll listen to the music.
Shorty Pedestine. I'm going to take a break here and ask you to fill out the course evaluation forms. Could you take 10 minutes on these? Thank you. Could you take 10 minutes on these, please? And here are the golf pencils. That's their technical name. And just please take a form and pass it. There you go. Oh, well, that's it. That's, okay, here's the golf message. So let's take 10 minutes on this, and then we will go and do, we'll talk more about Gary Snyder. You want to listen to a little music while you're filling out the forms? Will that get in the way? Oh, and is Kelly Klimek here?
Yeah.
Thanks, Kelly. Oh, is anyone going over to in the direction of Angel Hall? Okay, would you mind passing, when you get your evaluations done, would you mind passing them down to Princess? She's going to, And could you just take them up to the main, you know where the English office is? Yeah, just give them to them at the desk, please, and put them in this big envelope. Throw out the bad ones, you know. Thank you. those of you who are jazz fans, it's incredible what Herbie Hancock is playing on piano on this. You know, you probably know like Headhunter and Watermelon Man and those things that when later in the 60s when Herbie Hancock, and then in the early 70s when Herbie Hancock was doing the kind of funk stuff that made him rich, like Watermelon Man and that album Headhunter. Amazing how lyrical and beautiful and beautifully he's playing on this. This is the this is Miles Davis. You know, Miles Davis went into that kind of jazz called fusion, and this is right at the period. This is the last album that he made before he went into that period. I think it's the most. Oh, my mic's on. Thank you. This is the last album that Miles made just before he went into the electric kind of fusion period. I think this is the album that precedes Bitches Brew. So it's kind of the last of the old Miles. It's a really, really beautiful, beautiful album. The incredible Tony Williams on drums. It's called Miles Smiles. Pick it up. Now we're going to go back and talk more about Gary Snyder, Dharma Bombs, and so forth, Earth House Soul. Can I get you to give them all these pencils? Thank you very much. So those of you who are in the very, very select group, and you know who you are, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, then you don't need to even listen to what I'm saying. But those few of you who are in that very, very select little group, don't forget 1 o'clock today, okay? And here's the man that you're going to connect with, and you know all about that. And I just want to make sure that you know how to get in touch with John on email, because questions, you know, remember that I'm giving out the take-home exam on Thursday, and you're taking that home and doing it over the weekend and turning it back in on Monday. This is how you can get in touch with John on email. So more about Gary Snyder. Isn't it interesting how people look? I mean, isn't it interesting that this is how Kerouac describes him. He wore a little goatee, strangely oriental looking, with his somewhat slanted green eyes. I mean, isn't it interesting how people, since Gary Snyder was going to turn out to be someone who had a great interest in Japanese, Chinese literature, Asian philosophy, since he was interested in those cultures, isn't it interesting that there was a little bit of something in his appearance that would kind of remind you of those cultures? I mean, you know, it's an odd thing. I don't know if you believe in reincarnation or not. I just came up with a little information sheet for you about Gary Snyder's poetry. Most of this is being covered in our classes on Gary Snyder, because these might be interesting to you, and please give me back the extras. It was the wiry, suntanned, vigorous, open quality of Gary Snyder that really appealed to Jack Kerouac. I hope that information, you'll find that information sheet useful. Now, every generation, every artistic movement, every social movement has kind of certain defining events. I might think about for the anti-war political movement of the 1960s, it would be the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. For the introduction of modern art in America, it would be the Armory Show in New York City. For the hippies, it would be Woodstock. For the beat poets, the defining event was something called Six Poets at the Six Gallery. Kerouac describes this in Dharma Bums. He's talking about these poets who all get together. I'm looking at page 11, Dharma Bums. The other poets, he's talking about how he liked Snyder better than he liked these other guys, because as you know, Kerouac didn't have much use for people that he described as arty types or intellectuals or bohemians. He defines bohemians on a bohemian on page 10 as a hanger-oner around the arts. Did you ever stop and wonder where the word bohemian comes from? Well, Bohemia was a province of what used to be Czechoslovakia, and when they were going through their political troubles in the mid-19th century, a lot of Bohemians, people from Bohemia, moved to Paris, and they were kind of an artistic group, and other people interested in the arts hung with them. So they became known as the Bohemians, and that's why we call them that to this day. And in the 19th century, there started to be, really for the first time, an opposition between what? Between the avant-garde, the underground, people who were hip, as opposed to the establishment, people who were straight, mainstream values of all kinds in the arts and elsewhere. And it's interesting that that distinction between the in group and the straight group has continued, and we continue to use the word bohemian. Ray Smith describes the other poets on page 11, the other poets who are participating in this event called the Six Poets at the Six Gallery. The other poets were either horn-rimmed intellectual hepcats with wild black hair like Alva Goldbrook, or delicate, pale, handsome poets like O'Shea, or out-of-this-world, genteel-looking Renaissance Italians like Francis de Pavia. Now, we're not really studying the San Francisco Renaissance poets, but if we were, you would learn that Francis de Pavia is a surrealist writer named Philip LaMantia. And bow-tied, wild-haired old anarchist fuds like Reinhold Kakoethis. Now, Kakoethis, he represents a real-life character named Kenneth Rexroth. Kenneth Rexroth, this is Kenneth Rexroth reading one of his poems over music. This is called They Are Killing the Young Men. Interesting.
They are murdering all the young men. For half a century now, every day, they have hunted them down and killed them. They are killing them now, at this minute, all over the world. They are killing the young men.
Isn't this horrible?
They know 10,000 ways to kill them.
I mean, isn't it pompous?
Every year they invent new ones in the jungles of Africa,
portentous.
In the marshes of Asia, in the deserts of Asia, in the slave pens of Siberia, in the slums of Europe, in the nightclubs of America, the murderers are at work.
You gotta have the bow and cello, right?
They are stoning Stephen. They are casting him forth from every city in the world, under the welcome sign, under the rotary emblem, on the highway in the suburbs. His body lies under the hurling stone. He was full of faith and power. He did great wonders among the people. They could not stand against his wisdom. They could not bear the spirit with which he spoke. He cried out in the name of the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness. They were cut to the heart. They gnashed against him with their teeth. They cried out with a loud voice.
And
they stopped their ears.
A young man,
they ran on him with one accord.
Recognize.
They cast him out of the city and stoned him. The witnesses laid down their clothes.
I just wanted you to hear that kind of as an example of how bad it can get. But the funny thing is that Rex Roth was really quite an expert on jazz. I mean, Rex Roth understood stuff about jazz. He's a great writer on jazz. I mean, his insight that in modern jazz, ornamentation replaced melody. It's a kind of a simple idea, but once you cop to that idea, then you really understand something about modern jazz. I mean, I'm thinking about when Charlie Parker will be playing a tune and he'll get kind of interested in one in a little embellishment, and then he'll sort of leave the tune behind and just start running variations on that particular embellishment. It's an important thing to understand about jazz. Rex Roth was in many ways a very admirable character. I mean, he started off as a labor organizer in San Francisco. San Francisco was one of the early kind of labor hotbeds because the longshoremen there were organized into unions. Rex Roth was an anarchist. He did beautiful translations from Japanese and Chinese. His 100 poems from Chinese is really a terrific little book, and 100 poems from Japanese, they're really worth reading. But there must have been something about Rex Roth. You can tell from the name Cacoethes that Kerouac gives to him. It's not very complimentary. There was something about Rex Roth that must have been slightly unpleasant. Anyway, he's as you study literary history, there are figures. There are the kind of figures that get remembered, like Kerouac, Burroughs, Ginsberg, and then there are people that not too many people know about, like Kenneth Rexroth or Philip Whalen. They're sort of off to the side there. Kenneth Rexroth was the MC at this reading called Six Poets at the Six Gallery, where Howl was read for the first time, and a lot of the poems by Gary Snyder that we're studying were read for the first time. And one of the really interesting things about reading Dharma Bums side by side with Gary Snyder's poetry is that you can. There was Jack Kerouac, Jack Kerouac going out buying big jugs of wine and bringing them back in and passing them around, and encouraging the poets when they read by, standing in the back of the room yelling, go, go, go. At the same time, he was obviously taking notes on the reading. So his accounts of the reading, it's very interesting to compare them to the actual poems. So for example, in Dharma Bums, on page 14, when he's describing this event, which turned out to be a historic event, he talks about Jaffe reading and his anarchistic ideas about how Americans don't know how to live, with lines about commuters being trapped in living rooms that come from poor trees felled by chainsaws, showing here also his background as a logger up north. Well, all you have to do is turn to the back country, page 4. The chainsaw falls for boards of pine. Suburban bedrooms, block on block, will waver with this grain and not.
The maddening shapes will start and fade each morning when computers wake. Joint boards hung on frames, a box to catch the biped in. That's a passage that I talked about last time. But what's the difference between the way the poem is in Snyder's lines and the poem and the way the poem is in Kerouac's view of it? Really, I'd say the word poor, because if anything, if there's one thing you can say for certain about Snyder, it's that he was not sentimental. He would never talk about the poor trees felled by chainsaws. Kerouac did have a sentimental streak, and that's just that, you can see that one word, that's the difference. It says a lot about the difference in sensibility between these two characters, because Snyder doesn't moralize. That's one of the, he has kind of a cold objectivity. Also, you may remember the class that we did on Buddhism. Ray Smith says he's sitting, you know, outside the little cottage that he shares in Berkeley with Alva Goldbrook, i.e. Allen Ginsberg. Old rotten porch slanted forward to the ground among vines, with a nice old rocking chair that I sat in every morning and read my Diamond Sutra. So it's kind of interesting to look to the Buddhist scriptures themselves and see what the Buddha was saying. The Tathagata. Sanskrit's a really interesting language. I recommend it to you. Gata means to go. I think I was telling you, or I mean, that's the root. I was telling you about that that sutra that goes gate, gate, para gate, parasam gate. In other words, gone, completely gone, thoroughly gone. That's the same, that G-A-T, that root right there is the same as the, for the English word go. And what tata means, thusly. And so, okay, here's the name for the central, here's the Sanskrit name for the central figure in this religion, okay? I mean, you see what I'm talking about? It's like they would, like you would say, the Lord, or the Messiah, the Son of Man, the different names that we have for religious figures. What do they call the, in Sanskrit, what do they call the Buddha? Tathagata. It means literally, the one who goes like that. It's really an interesting term, see, because it's an interestingly kind of neutral term, the one who goes like that. I mean, what does that mean? It's something that you really couldn't understand without having an intuitive inner understanding of the tradition itself, of the Buddhist tradition itself. But this is something, think back to the class that we did on Buddhism, the Dharma, or law, universal law, which the Buddha has fully known or demonstrated. This is what it says in the Diamond Sutra. It cannot be grasped, it cannot be talked about. It is neither a dharma nor a non-dharma. This sutra has that typically elusive quality of so many things in Buddhism, sort of like, and remember what I was talking about Taoism, how much Zen Buddhism derives from Taoism? Kind of like, if you have to add, it's sort of like they say, how much does it cost to buy and maintain a yacht? If you have to ask, you can't afford it. It's the same thing in Buddhism, if you don't get it, there's basically no point in asking about it. It's just kind of a particular knack, and it's what they're talking about in Taoism when they say the way that can be grasped is not the true way. The highest truth is like water; it flows everywhere, but it doesn't have a kind of a substance to it, a verifiable. You can't go out and buy yourself a half ounce of the Tao. It's not a substance, you know. It's something that's, you can't explain it. And
that's, I guess that's the thing that makes Buddhism, particularly Zen Buddhism, so fascinating and at the same time so frustrating for a lot of people. And you know from reading this book that Ray Smith, the Jack Kerouac character, is intensely frustrated by the idea of Zen. He's much more comfortable with the old-fashioned or Hinayana kind of Buddhism that he has learned out of books. Why? Because it's all kind of laid out, and then secondly, because it's much closer to Catholicism that he grew up with, so he can understand it better. So when he talks about reading the Diamond Sutra, that's the kind of thing that he's reading. The fascinating thing about Gary Snyder for me, this is taken from the Backcountry, page 5, is that as being as intensely interested in the spiritual life as he is, he also equally loves the world of samsara. You remember that samsara means the wheel of birth, death, and rebirth. And he's talking about a pregnant woman, belly stretched taut in a bulge, breast swelling as you guzzle beer. Who wants nirvana? You know, this is so kind of, well, we used to say essency. You know, it's just so kind of earthy and real and of the essence of life. I mean, what could be more representative of the just pure, full-out thusness, thisness, itness of life than a pregnant woman drinking a bottle of beer? Here is water, wine, beer, enough books for a week. So that's the thing you're talking about, that this interestingly balanced and integrated personality of Gary Snyder, somebody who's very spiritually inclined, but also someone who loves the things of this world very much. Now, I hope you're not going to be put on the spot, but could you just give us a little announcement?
Yeah, I'm going to give you the short version. We have a little thing that we normally read, but this class is being recorded, and if anybody has any objections or any questions about the project that I'm working on, feel free to ask me about it after class. Does anybody object? Okay, good. Thanks.
Okay, well, I mean, no, I don't see why anyone would object. One of my real favorite poems by Snyder is this one called How to Make Stew in the Pinacate Desert. It's on page 28 in the Backcountry. I mean, isn't this great? It's just a how-to poem, how to make stew. But it's not just a recipe. In the process of telling you how to make stew, it just tells you so much, it suggests so much about how enjoyable life is, you know, and it tells you so much about the way of life he's leading. We have no idea who Locke and Drum are. We figure they're friends of his who asked him to give them a recipe for stew. How to make stew in the Pinacate Desert, recipe for Locke and Drum. H.A. Bayless Market, bent wire roller basket, buy up parsnips. So there you are in the supermarket, right? Buy up parsnips, onion, carrot, rutabaga, potato, bell, green pepper, 9 cuts of dark beef shank. They run there on their legs. That makes the meat tasty. What's he talking about? He's talking about free-range beef. 7 at night in Tucson. Get some Bisquick for the dumplings. Have some bacon. You know, it's like you don't go out and buy it. You've already got it. It's in the fridge somewhere. Go to Hadley's in the kitchen right beside the frying steak. Diana on the phone. See, it's a whole picture of the lives that Snyder and his friends are leading. Diana on the phone. Get a little plastic bag from Drum. Fill it up with tarragon and chili. 4 bay leaves, black peppercorns and basil, powdered oregano, something free, maybe about 2 teaspoons worth of salt. Something free, maybe you go out in your garden and just pick some weird herb and put that in there too, some tansy or something like that. Now down in Sonora, Pinacate country, build a fire of ocotillo, broken twigs. You know what those look like, the ocotillo? It's really beautiful. They bloom in early spring, a bright red flowering bush, an incredible thing.
Broken twigs and bits of ironwood in an open ring of lava. Rake some coals aside if you're smart to windward. It's telling you all about how to build a fire. It's a great, I hope some of you guys are going camping as soon as the term's over. Set drums, 14-inch Dutch oven with three legs across the embers. It tells you all how to do it. Put the, you know, the bacon in, the veg, have all your vegetables cleaned up, etc. Cover it up with a hot lid, all heavy and white, or drink Budweiser beer. And also mix the dumpling mix, and then he says, dish it up and eat it with a spoon sitting on a poncho in the dark. You know, and if you've lived this way, and you know how true to life this is, when just exactly how good this is going to taste when he gets around to when you get around to eating it. So, you know, it's not. There are many poems by Snyder that are really difficult. Whereas you read them and you feel as if you've had to have read a lot of Buddhist scriptures and everything, or you have to know a lot about the anthropology of the California Indians. But it's wonderful that he's also capable of writing these very, very simple and straightforward poems as well. Snyder, as a naturalist, oh, that's a little bit, I should have clicked on that. Snyder, as a naturalist, his understanding of the big picture, you know, history from the huge panorama of which our lives as human beings are just tiny little dots, all that knowledge informs a poem like one called Burning the Small Dead, Backcountry. Let's see, I'm not ready for that yet. Backcountry, page 13, Burning the Small Dead. Let's look at this. It's just about making a fire up in the mountains. Burning the small dead branches broke from beneath thick spreading white bark pine. 100 summers, snow melt, rock and air, hiss in a twisted bough. Sierra granite, Mount Ritter, black rock twice as old, Deneb, Altair, windy fire. Did anyone look up Deneb and Altair in the dictionary?
Stars. Yeah.
They're stars. So what's happening in this poem? He's lighting a fire from these pines, and as they burn, 100 summers of snow melt, which gives the pines their I don't know if you've ever been high up in like in the mountains where you see trees that seem to be growing out of rock. These trees that get their water from the snow melt and, you know, their nourishment from the air growing out of rock, 100 summers hiss in a twisted bough. All that growth that went in to make that tree, that hisses in this fire that you're building. And then he just thinks about the rock, Sierra granite, Mount Ritter, black rock twice as old. He's just contemplating the geological lives of all this rock out of which the trees have grown. And then he's thinking about fire, because the poem is called Burning the Small Dead. And so where does his mind jump to? The stars. It's really nice. Here's a fire that I'm building, burning these trees. Then bang, what's another kind of fire? The stars. And what's another kind of a fire? The volcanic activity that created these rocks, this black rock right here. So it's really an interesting, that's kind of where you have to be when you're reading Snyder, is to be able to make those mental leaps, going from one kind of, in this particular case, going from one kind of fire to another. I'm having you read the prose book, Earth Household, side by side with Dharma Bums and the Backcountry. I call your attention to the subtitle of Earth Household, Technical Notes and Queries to Fellow Dharma Revolutionaries. Dharma from Buddhism, revolution from Marxism. So it's an interesting coalescence between Eastern thought as represented by Buddhism and Western thought as represented by Marxism. I think it's hard now that the Soviet Union has, now that the Berlin Wall has fallen, now that the Soviet Union has disappeared, has disintegrated, now that Marxism, as it has come down to us in history, now that we're living in a post-Marxist, post-communist world, I think it's very hard for people of your age to understand the power that Marxism carried at its height. Because you see, Marxism represents itself as being scientific, and therefore its ideas had the cachet of historical inevitability. That's why when Nikita Khrushchev talked at the United Nations, he took his shoe off, pounded the table, and addressing the American ambassador, or American representative directly, he said, "We will bury you," because the Marxists felt that they had the inevitability of history on their side, that the revolution was coming, and it was going to happen just as surely as summer was going to turn into fall. See, so that's all, that sense of the historical inevitability of Marxism has just about disappeared from the human scene. But in the 50s, when Snyder was writing, he felt as if the revolution was definitely coming. And when he said, when he talks about notes and queries to fellow Dharma revolutionaries, he's addressing himself to a group of like-minded people who feel that the revolution is inevitably coming, and what can we do to make the revolution be the kind of revolution that we want it to be. I'm kind of flip-flopping back and forth here between the serious intellectual, political, spiritual side of Snyder and the more kind of laid-back, earthy side. You remember we read a poem called Night. Here's a poem called North Beach Alba. Alba means what? It means white. And it's white because a lot of times when you get up in the morning in the Bay Area, the whole thing is socked in with fog, with white fog. It may be a great bank of white fog drifting in towards San Francisco over the bay. Waking half drunk in a strange pad, making it out to the cool gray San Francisco dawn, white gulls over white houses, fog down the bay. Tamalpais, a fresh green hill in the new sun, driving across the bridge in a beat old car to work. That's nice, isn't it? You see the different kinds of white in it, the white gulls, the white houses, the fog on the bay. Mount Tamalpais is the mountain in Marin County that you see when you look across the bay from San Francisco. They call it the Sleeping Lady, which Indians live there? Madoc Indians called it the Sleeping Lady because it looks like a woman reclining. So what are we going to do now? We're going to talk about Gary Snyder's main ideas in Earth Household. They are six. And they are as follows. The interdependence in his own thinking and in the thinking of like-minded people between Buddhism and revolution.